Oh, dear Lord, thank you so much for this week, God. Thank you, Lord, for all the rain, even though it's extremely inconvenient for us. God, I thank you so much for it, and just so glad that we can see it and know that we're protected still, Lord, through everything and through bad weather, and you're with us, driving with us, and in our homes with us, God, no matter what we may be going through. And I just pray that you would just be here tonight, that you would open our hearts and minds for what you have to teach us. Speak through me, God, and pray for anybody that's out driving, God. I just pray for protection, that you would just send your angels to be with your children, God, as they're out driving, and just prevent accidents and just keep people safe in this weather, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so tonight is on Does God Exist? The Case for a Monotheistic God. Obviously, you can just reason to any type of supernatural entity instead of saying, oh, I'm specifically going to go for a monotheistic God. If you can get an atheist or a materialist to get to the point of admitting, okay, there's probably something out there besides us, that's a huge step. But I always go one further, and I say, well, let's try to reason to a monotheistic God, because that gets us one step closer to introducing Jesus to them. But the thing with this issue is you can't put the cart before the horse. So that's why I talk a little bit about the concept of worldviews before I jump into the existence of God. It's extremely important to understand someone's worldview before you try to introduce them to God, because you have to know where they're at in order to know where to reason with them from. So obviously, if they're a Muslim, you don't need to start with, does God exist, right? You would start with, who is God? What kind of God is he? Rather than, does God exist? So, that being said, there are basically four main worldviews regarding isms, basically, of what people believe about the supernatural. And so once you understand where somebody fits in these worldviews, you can understand where to start reasoning with them from. So the four main are naturalism, monotheism, pantheism, and polytheism. And the thing is that within these, there's still even further subcategories that they're divided into. For example, in polytheism, you have multiple equal gods, or you have henotheism underneath that, which is one large god and then a bunch of little gods. Like in Greek mythology, you have Zeus, and then you have all the little lesser gods. Or in Hinduism, you have Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma, yeah. And then you've got the 300 million other little gods. So there's different types of polytheism. Obviously, monotheism, we know that our monotheism is different from Islam's monotheism. They have what's called an absolute monotheism, and we have a compound monotheism, meaning we believe three in one, and they believe there's only one. Specifically, in this section, we're obviously going to be mostly dealing with atheism, agnosticism, and humanism, trying to get them to reason to that there's something else out there besides us. But, for example, pantheism is basically God is the universe. It's impersonal. God's an impersonal force in pantheism. So it's like Buddhism or Taoism, like Star Wars, tapping into the force, Kung Fu Panda. Those types of worldviews are going to be more the Taoism, God is all, God's in us all, that kind of a thing. Polytheism obviously is multiple gods. Again, there can be a hierarchy in there, or they can just all be equal to each other. Mormons are polytheists. So it's funny, when I give this talk sometimes, it's a different version of this talk. And I put the theisms or the isms up on the board, and then I say, okay, where would Mormonism fit? And they always pick monotheism. But actually, they're polytheists. They believe that men can become God and that God was once a man. And so they do believe in multiple gods. They would actually fall under polytheism. Then you've got, under pantheism, you've also got panentheism, which is a whole other subculture of that. And it's basically a mix of theism and pantheism, that God is in the universe as the soul is in the body. So not only is God the universe, but he's also in the universe. It gets really complicated. You've got finite godism, meaning, you know, if God is in this universe, then he can't be outside of it. You know, we know that our God is not only immanent, but he's also transcendent. So it does, that worldview has some problems. But basically, these are the four main, and like I said, within them, there's going to be these different subcategories. But for tonight, we're really going to focus on the naturalism. And then throughout the rest of the semester, we'll kind of deal with each one of these other ones a little bit when we talk about those worldviews. Specifically, atheism. Atheism states there is no God. Theos obviously means God. When you put an A in front of anything in the Greek language, it means without or no. So, atheos means no God. Whenever you guys are looking at, you know, a word in English that has come from the Greek, if it's gotten the A in the front, then you can kind of reason from what it's trying to tell you. In atheism, no God exists in or beyond the universe. There's no miracles. They do believe that evil is a reality, that injustice and evil is a phenomenon that does happen in the world, which is good, because if they're willing to admit that evil is real, then you can start talking with them about, okay, well, why do you call that evil? How do you define evil? If it's the absence of good, how do you know what good is? And you can use the C.S. Lewis, if you can know what something's unjust, how do you know what's just argument? But the hard thing about atheism is that they're basically saying there is no God. And that's a categorical statement saying universally there is no God. But the thing is, an atheist obviously isn't omnipresent. So they haven't been everywhere all at once, at all times, in all places. So they can't actually say for sure there is no God based on their knowledge. So the problem is they have these challenges that they have to answer. So, for example, why is there anything at all if there's no first cause? How do we get life from non-life? How do we get intelligence from non-intelligence, something from nothing? They can't answer these questions. And so either they go into an infinite regress, meaning, oh, well, there was this chain of events and something started it, or it was an eternal chain of events. But they really have no answer for what started it all. They aren't able to basically give the answer that would be the satisfying answer, basically, for someone's worldview. And so you can push them on it. You can say, you know, you can't actually say there is no God because, you know, you haven't been everywhere all at once. So you're not able to actually say there is no God. You believe that there is no God. But that's just because you feel like you don't have enough information to say that there is one. Well, then you say you're basically a soft form of agnosticism. Agnosticism means they don't know if there's a God or not. Gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge. Knowledge through experience, basically. And then obviously, again, is without or no. So agnosis or agnosticism means without or no knowledge. The thing is that with an atheist, and they're going to say staunchly, you know, there is no God, no questions asked. But agnosticism is a kind of precarious state to live in, because you're saying, well, I'm not sure. I don't have enough information to say that there is no God, but there could be. And then at that point, you can be like, well, really, what is the better way to live? And so sometimes, depending on the person, sometimes Pascal's wager works and sometimes it doesn't. But Pascal's wager basically says, look, if you live as a Christian your whole life and the atheist view turns out to be right and there's no God, you've lost nothing. You've actually lived a life full of joy and hope and fellowship and unity and, you know, belief in something greater than yourself. And so that's, you didn't lose anything by living as a Christian if the atheist is correct. However, on the other side, if the Christian's correct and you live as an atheist, you're going to lose everything at the end. And so some people resonate with that. Some people don't. There's definitely debate on whether or not you should use Pascal's wager. But I've seen it work with some people, you know, because really you think you weigh the odds. What's the best way to live in order to get the best results? So also, as we stated in the last lecture, agnosticism is self-defeating because they claim the one thing they know about God is that they can't know anything about God. Again, they do know something, namely that he can't be known. So even if there was no evidence for God, it would still be the most logical choice to become a Christian rather than not. But lucky for us, there is a lot of evidence for God. So we'll get into that. So we're going to go through five basic arguments for the existence of God tonight. There's a lot of them, but I'm only going to do five because outside of the five that I'm going to do, the rest of them really are more in depth, ones that you're not going to need to use with the average person. So the first one is cosmological. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. And if you look at that, you can kind of recognize what we talked about last week. It's a logical syllogism. It's two premises and a conclusion. So now that we've put this syllogism out in the world, it's on us. We have the burden of proof to prove the first two premises in order to get to the conclusion. So we'll go through each one of those, and then we'll be able to prove our conclusion. This is also known as the Kalam cosmological argument. So if you see someone talking about the Kalam argument, that's the same thing. Kalam is an Arabic word meaning eternal. And it was actually put together formally by Muslim apologists in the Middle Ages. So whatever begins to exist has a cause. So now we're going to go through premise one. So anything that exists can only come about in three ways. If something exists, it's either uncaused, self-caused, or caused by another. Uncaused is impossible because we wouldn't be here. So obviously that one we can rule out because we're here. We do exist. Self-caused is impossible because man can't exist outside or prior to himself in order to create himself. So we know for a fact that we're not self-caused because that's impossible. Therefore, we must be caused by another. So anything that begins to exist has a cause. This is also known as the law of causality. It's basically existence equals cause. Or what? If there's an effect, we know there's a cause, right? We are an effect, therefore there is a cause. So we say, okay, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Law of causality, if there's an effect, if there's an existence, there must be a cause. The universe began to exist. This is the one that you're going to get the pushback on. Very few people are going to deny that if you exist, you have a cause. That's going to be, unless they're somebody that doesn't live in reality and says that I don't believe we're actually here, whatever, they're not going to push back on premise one. They're going to push back on premise two. So how do we prove that the universe began to exist? There are four proofs for the origin of the universe or for the fact that the universe had a starting point. And we'll go through each one of these. But first, we live in an expanding universe. Second, the universe shows signs of an explosive beginning. Third, the first law of thermodynamics. And four, the second law of thermodynamics. The reason you're going to get pushback here is because atheists believe the universe is eternal. They don't believe it had a beginning. So they're going to push you for, you know, evidence that the universe had a starting point. So first, we'll go through expanding universe. How do we know we live in an expanding universe? So when I say expanding universe, I mean that the universe is moving outwards in every direction. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So if something's getting bigger or pushing outwards, what does that mean if you go backwards in time? Right, it started. So if we live in a universe that's expanding or pushing itself outward, then we know that at some point there was a beginning. Obviously, things in motion stay in motion. Things at rest stay at rest, right? It's physics. So if something's in motion, meaning it's pushing outwards, there had to be an external force on it in order for it to even start. So Edwin Hubble discovered that galaxies are moving away from each other at high speeds. And he said if one were to reverse this process, the universe would become infinitely dense. So basically, we would get to this really tiny point. And we'll talk about what scientists believe about that. So actually, expanding universe, if someone's like, oh, you know, how do you know we live in an expanding universe? Well, do you believe Edwin Hubble was, you know, a valid person to trust when it comes to stuff like this? And if they say yes, we'll then be like, okay, well, he's the one, you know, who discovered the expanding universe in 1929. So, Hugh Ross said that if the expansion rate of the universe were slightly slower, the whole universe would have re-collapsed before any solar-type stars could have settled into a stable burning phase. If the universe were expanding at slightly more rapidly, no galaxies and hence no stars would have condensed from the general expansion. How critical is this expansion rate? According to Alan Guth, it must be fine-tuned to an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the 55th power. That is 1 in 10 with 55 zeros following. So not only is the universe expanding, but at the rate at which it's expanding is so perfect that it allows for stability in the universe. So if it was any slower, it would have recollapsed before we could have had any type of suns at all, which we need our sun to survive, right? We'll talk more about that in a minute, but, if it were any faster, no galaxies would have condensed, so we wouldn't have galaxies, basically, no groupings. So the expansion rate, not only is it expanding, but the rate at which it is extremely important and finely tuned. Second, proof for the fact that the universe began to exist is that there's signs of an explosive beginning. The universe began to began from a state of infinite density. Space and time were created in that event, and so was all the matter in the universe. That was a quote from "Will the Universe Expand Forever?" in a 1976 issue of Scientific American. A bunch of respected astronomers basically got together, published this article, and said the universe began from a state of infinite density. In 1965, Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias discovered substantial levels of radiation the same wavelength as a large explosion, a Big Bang perhaps. This radiation wave shows signs of an explosive beginning. So basically, they've discovered levels of radiation that show that there was a large explosion, and we can go back to that, and we can say, okay, the universe exploded into being at some point in the past. Well, I have no problem with that. People are always like, oh, Big Bang, no, you know, that's so evolutionary and evil. Don't God create it? And you're like, yes, but think about this. There was nothing, and then there was everything. So in a moment, God spoke matter into existence. That's going to have repercussions of an explosive beginning. So regardless of how that stuff exploded into being, you know, we can haggle over that, what the catalyst was. But regardless, is it there was nothing, and then there was a bunch of something. So that would follow with the whole idea of radiation levels kind of being pushed outwards. Second, fireball radiation. So Jastrow says, no explanation other than the Big Bang has been found for the fireball radiation. The clincher, which has convinced almost the last doubting Thomas, is that the radiation discovered by Penzias and Wilson has exactly the pattern of wavelengths expected for the light and heat produced in a great explosion. At the present time, the Big Bang theory has no competitors. Now again, the Big Bang theory he's talking about is that at one point in the past, this infinite dense dot of stuff, where that stuff came from, they have no explanation for, exploded, and that's how we get everything. Well, for us, we can say, okay, yes, but the first cause of that stuff exploding was probably a creator of some sort. So, but regardless of what you believe about what the catalyst was, there was some point in time where the universe exploded into being. It started at some point in the past.
But why would some Christians then argue that the Big Bang is not good theology, so to speak?
Well, because they're afraid of what the next question is. So which they shouldn't be. So, because what will happen is if you start saying, and this is where you talk about defining your terms and logic. If you start going around as a Christian saying, I believe the Big Bang, what's the assumption?
Evolution,
right? And that's the reason they don't want to say that, is because they're afraid of being lumped in with the evolutionists. But really, if we're all just honest with each other, if you have a bunch of nothing and then there's a bunch of something, there was some type of explosion of stuff that happened. I mean, when we think about how God created, when you get to like day, whenever he created everything adult, obviously he created the earth in an adult phase, meaning Adam was able to live on it. Everything was grown. Everything was ready to go. It's not like he started with this dirt surface with a bunch of seeds. Like, everything was fully grown. And so, you know, all of a sudden there was a bunch of fully grown stuff. And then, there was nothing. And then there was a bunch of fully grown stuff. So there wasn't this slow process of, God taking his time to make things happen. And so it would make sense that it would be explosive, especially if you ignore the earth for a minute. Let's put the earth aside and you just say there was nothing, and then all of a sudden there's stars, galaxies, planets, you know, that all that stardust just exploded into being from God speaking. You know, that's going to be explosive, because it was very quick.
So where would you put that then? Is it before Genesis 1:1, or is it the Genesis 1:1 and then the Big Bang?
Isn't that the question? So now this is why you have Christians on every side of the debate as far as old earth, young earth, old universe, young universe. I mean, you have people who are like, okay, like my dad is staunchly 6 days, 10,000 years ago, no questions asked. I mean, there was nothing 10,000 years ago, and now the universe and the earth and everything was created in that, you know. But then you have men like Hugh Ross who are brilliant and, you know, think, okay, there was an old universe but a young earth, meaning God created the universe a long time ago, but then the earth is young, which is why you have the appearance of a young earth. but then you also have stars and things that are old enough to where light years would explain the billions of, you know, light years away they are. And then you have people who are, you know it's old Earth and old universe. And because you have this debate of, okay, well, when did it actually happen? And so if you look at Genesis, this is personally what I think. If you look at Genesis 1:1, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. That's an introduction. Moses is giving an introduction. He's not giving you the whole story in Genesis 1:1. He's saying, here's what I'm about to tell you about, you know. And then Genesis 1:2 is the beginning of the story, right? That's line. Genesis 1:2 is once upon a time, right? And then Genesis 1:1 is the thesis, really. You know, he's like, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's what I'm about to tell you about. And now Genesis 1:2, here's the beginning of the story. Once upon a time, there was nothing upon the face of the earth, or there was nothing, and God, then all of a sudden there was, you know, God spoke and everything came about. Darkness was upon the waters, the earth was an empty void, whatever. And some people say, well, this is the whole story, this is the whole story, and then something must have happened here, because then now everything's empty again. But that's not literature. Like, Moses was a writer, like, he was an editor, like, he would have made it literary. So Genesis 1:1 is basically, here's what I'm about to tell you about, here's a summary of it. And then Genesis 1:2 is the beginning. Everything was void, and then there was stuff. And then, honestly, I believe that goes all the way to Adam. And at the end, Genesis 1:26 through 27, he says, make man in our image. I think this is an overview of making human beings, because he says making, you know, man and woman. But then you'll notice in Genesis, and I don't have my Bible in front of me. I should have my Bible for a second. No, it's okay. They're right. Okay. So it says, you know, God saw everything that he had made. Indeed, it was very good. So the evening and morning were the sixth day. Done. Created human beings, man and woman, all good. God rested on the seventh day. This is the history of the heavens and the earth. Before they were created, in the day the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, before any planet of the earth would fail. Okay, so basically at this point, he's explaining, okay, now let me tell you about the day, the sixth day. Let me tell you about the sixth day when God created Adam. The interesting thing is that you'll see in Genesis 2:7, it says, the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. Man became a living being. Then the Lord God planted a garden eastward of Eden. So it's interesting because people don't really notice that God actually created the garden in front of Adam. So Adam, God created everything, created Adam, created the garden in front of Adam, and then created Eve after Adam had been in the garden. And so one of the most interesting things is people are like, oh, well, why did Satan go to Eve? I believe he went to Eve because she's the only one that didn't see God create anything. She's living by faith. Adam had actually seen God create the garden, so he knew who had the power, right? But, you know, when people say, oh, the Big Bang must have happened here, you have this gap theory where they believe, you know, everything was destroyed. That's just not the case. If you just look at the story, especially, like I said, the way that he goes into Genesis 2, he repeats the same thing. He says, here's what I want to tell you about. Here's the story. Then he goes to Genesis 2:1. Here's the story again, the overview, the thesis, and then here's what happened on the sixth day. So you can see this pattern in the first few chapters of Genesis. That's how you know that there was nothing, that there was no cataclysmic event that happened in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, which, if you believe that, that's called the gap theory. There's this gap of thousands of millions of years that happened in between here, which is how some people explain that the universe is billions of years old and the earth is young, because stuff happened here and then the earth was created again or whatever.
So in your theory, then, the Big Bang actually occurred before Genesis 1?
Yes. Okay. Yes. The Big Bang would be the well, are you asking in my Big Bang or like the evolutionary view of the Big Bang?
Your view.
My view would be the explanation of this, the explanation of Genesis 1:1. Yeah.
So, and I made my piece with that whole Big Bang thing, thinking it kind of fits. What do you think God's voice sounded like when he spoke?
Well, right.
And said, let there be. And you were, like you were saying earlier, look what came into being. It's huge.
Yeah.
Don't you think it would have made a little noise?
Yeah. Well, right. And then, like, you know, you've got people who have made the connection of, okay, the universe.
What is the unit word for universe? If you break it up into its prefix and suffix, you have a single sentence, you know, or you have some. So
now I'm not saying that that's like, you know, a theory or anything, but some people have put that together saying, well, why did they call it a universe? Maybe it's because the people who named these things originally were believers. And so they used the Latin and that's how we got it. But yeah, so my view of the Big Bang is that it's basically Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There was nothing, and then there's a bunch of stuff. But it was explosive. It was nothing, and then there was something. So that would explain how we get the radiation waves and the evidence of an explosive beginning. You also have a cosmic background explorer. NASA launched the COBE satellite in order to validate the fireball radiation that Penzias and Wilson had discovered. If the universe had a beginning, scientists should expect to see ripples or variations in the temperature of the radiation. These ripples would allow galaxies to form by providing an environment for matter to congregate or come together due to gravitational force. You know, they said actually when they found these findings, they said if you're religious, it's like looking at God. So it's this idea that you need some type of catalyst for galaxies to form. They aren't just going to come together on their own. First of all, where did the stuff come from in the first place? And second of all, what force pushed them together in such a way that their galaxies would form perfectly? And again, when we talked about the radiation, the rate of the expansion, the moving outwards, it's finely tuned. So there's an order to it. To allow just enough matter to form galaxies, any difference in precision, none of the galaxies would have formed. So, also part of explosive beginning, you have an atheist, Anthony Kenney. He says, according to the Big Bang theory, the whole matter of the universe began to exist at a particular time in the remote past. A proponent of such a theory, at least if he is an atheist, must believe that the matter of the universe came from nothing by nothing. So again, we're talking about, you know, even if you do believe there was some type of Big Bang, well, what stuff blew up? What stuff was there? How did that stuff get there originally that could blow up? And so that's when you get, like I was telling you guys before, like atheists like Lawrence Krauss, who are like, well, nothing isn't really nothing. There's actually something, but it's so small that we can call it nothing. But he's saying, look, if you're an atheist, you have to say, like, that nothing exploded, and that's where, you know. So he's saying the burden of proof is on the atheist here. And as an atheist, that's big for them to admit. Robert Jastrow, who's also an atheist, says, now we see how the astronomical evidence leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. The details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. The chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time in a flash of light and energy. Some scientists are unhappy with the idea that the world began in this way. Well, yeah, of course they are, because then what? That means that they have to explain where this burst of energy came from, you know? Because, point three, the first law of thermodynamics, matter and energy both had a beginning and have been constant ever since. So if the world was eternal, then we would have to have energy come to a point of equilibrium. And that hasn't happened yet, right? The amount of energy in the universe, which we'll talk about in a second, is we're losing it. It's winding down. And so we know, because we haven't reached a point of equilibrium, that there was some point in the past that energy began and had a beginning point. So if they had a beginning, they must have had a beginner. They're not infinite, so they have not just always been there.
Wait, does that push matter and energy both have a beginning and have been constant ever since?
Yeah, because it's plural.
Constant amount of it is just changing how it's...
So we live in a closed universe.
Okay.
So that means that there's nothing new coming in.
Okay.
So whatever is in here has been in here since the beginning.
Okay.
And we know that we're using it up because of the second law of thermodynamics, which we'll get into in a second. But yeah, but the if the universe was eternal, it would have been, it would exist in such a way that we would have come to an equilibrium of energy. It wouldn't, nothing would wind down. The law of entropy wouldn't take place if the universe was eternal. It would just constantly replenish itself because we live in an open universe. I know this is more. You get into them. You get into this deep science, and if you want to know more, I definitely suggest reading. You know, people who have done deep work on this.
If there was a big bang, there had to be a banger.
Right.
I kind of like that.
Right. Yeah. So because of the second law of thermodynamics, number four, entropy is taking place. So the amount of usable energy in a closed system is running down. If the universe was infinite, the Earth would have never run out of energy and be in a state of equilibrium.
Well, see, that seems to contradict what the first one was that this constant amount doesn't change.
Right. Well, at a constant rate of use. So the rate that we're using it is constant.
Okay.
So, like, for example, food gets moldy. Clothes wear out. Even in the Bible, it talks about the garments of the earth will grow old and that kind of a thing.
Okay.
So if the universe was infinite, we'd be living in an open system, meaning we'd be constantly taking in new energy,
right.
And then we would just be at the state of equilibrium.
So the rate of energy use is constant in that first slide?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, see, here it is, Psalm 102:25. It says, of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will endure. Yes, they will grow old like a garment, like a cloak. You will change them, and they will be changed. But you are the same, and your years have no end. Okay. So now we've seen that not only does... anything that exists has to have a cause because of causality, the law of cause and effect. The universe began to exist because of these four points. At some point in time, there's an explosive beginning. There's signs of radiation from a big explosion. We have the first and second law of thermodynamics. So, therefore, the universe has a cause. Many atheists and scientists are abandoning Darwin's theories as amount of evidence proved that there was a designer. So the great skeptic David Hume wrote, but allow me to tell you that I never asserted so absurd a proposition as that anything might arise without a cause. J. L. Mackey, who's a prominent atheist, said, I myself find it hard to accept the notion of self-creation from nothing, even unrestricted chance. So it's interesting because if you really, really press an atheist, you can get them to the point where they have to admit that the idea that there's something coming from nothing is a little absurd. And then once you get them to that point, you can kind of reason with them, okay, well, now that we've kind of agreed that there had to have been something, let's talk about what that something was. What was that catalyst from the beginning? What started? And, you know, that's the hardest point is that they'll say, oh, well, there didn't need to be a first cause. And then you get, like I said, you get in this chain of events, this infinite regress with them. But... you know, if you can get an atheist to this point, that there is a cause of the universe, then you have a good chance of getting them to the next step, which is then let's talk about what type of cause this had to be. If the universe was caused, then there had to be a specific type of cause. It couldn't just be, you know, anything. There had to be a certain kind to get the effect that we have today. So this first caused had to be uncaused itself. Obviously, because why? You can't exist outside of yourself in order to cause yourself. So that means it had to be eternal. Dr. Geisler always says, you can't pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Basically meaning that God had to always have been there, because you can't be outside of yourself to create yourself. He has to be supernatural because it brought into existence the whole natural order. He must be outside and above space, time, and matter. Again, he had to be eternal since it takes one outside the temporal world to create time, or else the cause itself would be temporal. He's a creator of time, not a creator in time. He has to be immutable, meaning he doesn't change. If the first cause is eternal, then he can't change because change is measured in time, right? Change is before and afters. That's a chronological measurement. However, the first cause does not have any before or afters. It just always was. Malachi 3:6, I am the Lord, I change not. It has to be omnipotent or all-powerful. Power is what can affect change in something. Remember, he had to have power, the cause, in order to have the effect. You have to have power to bring something from nothing. Omniscient, meaning he had to be all-knowing. Obviously, a first cause has to know everything because he has to know all about biology in order to have sustainable life. He has to know about astronomy in order to have everything just so in the space-time universe, physics, mathematics, geology, all that had to be in the blueprints of the universe and in human beings in order for us to survive. And so the first cause had to have all that. Monotheistic, there can only be one. There cannot be more than one infinite, all-perfect God. So, and then when we get into Jesus and we talk about the Trinity, we'll talk a little bit about how that works. Because then people are like, well, what about Jesus? Because he's God, and, you know, so we'll talk about that later. Simple means not that he's dumb, but that he's not composed of parts. Parts imply composition or being put together. Composition implies a composer. So if you are not all that you would ever need to be, the way God is, that would mean that he's lacking something. And God's perfect, so he doesn't lack. Therefore, he's simple, meaning he doesn't have parts to him. He's the same always. He's full, and he always will be full, and he's been full from eternity. Okay. So the reason we go through the first cause list of what this first cause has to be, as I was saying before, is that there's only one particular God and one particular religion that fits the bill of what this first cause would need to be in order to create the effect of what there is today. So at that point, you can kind of say, okay, if the first cause has to fit this bill to get the effect of the world today, then let's talk about which religion and which God fits the bill. Then you kind of reason to Christianity from there. So then the next argument for the existence of God is the teleological argument. And this is the argument from design. So design implies designer. The universe manifests design or has design. Therefore, the universe has a designer. So now again, since this is a logical syllogism, we have to prove our first two premises before we can come to the conclusion. So first, design implies designer. Well, you can prove this pretty easily, right? Because what? A watch means a watchmaker. Painting implies an artist. A clay pot means there's a potter. A building means there's not a builder, an architect. I know, I always do that. I guess a builder, but... there has to be someone that designs it. that decides, okay, if I put this beam here, it's going to hold up this building in such a way that, you know, it's going to help it to stay around for a long period of time. Or in California, we have to think about, okay, if there's an earthquake, this building has to sway and not just crumble apart. This is very easy. This premise is very easy to prove. So then we just move on to the second one, the universe manifests design. This is a little bit more difficult because some people will push you back on this and say, oh, well, there is no design. Everything's just kind of chaotic and disordered. Look at how bad the world is. Obviously, there's no one making sure things run the way they're supposed to. But morality is different than function, right? So just because you look around the world and you see, oh, okay, there's evil, that doesn't mean the world was built wrong, right? Because function is different from morality. But Romans 1:20 says, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. So the Bible says, yes, the universe does show that there is some type of design happening. Outside of the Bible, how do we show that? The first way is the golden spiral. So this is a spiral that is commonly seen in shells but exists in many living and non-living things. The reason it's interesting is because it follows a precise mathematical pattern. If you look at a sunflower, you'll observe two sets of spirals. You'll see the rows of seeds and then the petals spiraling in opposite directions. When you count these rows in each direction, you'll discover that depending on the size of the flower, they will be of the following ratio. If small, the differences will be 34 and 55. If medium size, they'll be 55 and 89. And if large, they'll be 89 and 144. Okay, why does that matter? Does anybody recognize those numbers? Maybe a fan of the Da Vinci Code? So the interesting thing about these numbers that make up this spiral is that they're part of the Fibonacci sequence. So the pattern of the Fibonacci sequence was discovered in AD, around AD 1200, by Leonardo Pisa, who is actually historically known as Fibonacci. That was what people called him. Fibonacci was the one who discovered it would be easier to do math with Arabic numbers, which is 1, 2, and 3, instead of Roman numerals, which would be awful. Can you imagine doing algebra with Roman numerals? I mean, kill me now, right? So the interesting thing about the Fibonacci sequence is each succeeding number is the sum of the two preceding numbers, meaning 3 is the sum of 1 and 2, 5 is the sum of 2 and 3, 8 is the sum of 3 and 5. You guys following me? Okay. Well, the interesting thing about that, okay, that goes on forever, by the way. The interesting thing about that is when the smaller number is divided into the larger number next to it, the ratio will be approximately 1.618. So if you take 8 divided by 5, you'll approximately get 1.618 or something similar to that. When the larger number is divided into the smaller number, so when you do 5 divided by 8, you'll get 0.618, you know, something similar to that. This ratio is only true for this set of numbers. So the reason this is interesting is that when you put a rectangle, you have, let's say this side is 1, this side will always be 1.618, or this side will be 0.618, and this side will be 1, approximately. That would be a golden rectangle. We get the golden spiral because of how it fits in the golden rectangle when it's perfectly divided up into certain sections. The reason the golden rectangle is interesting is because it's the divine proportion, meaning that it produces the most pleasing aesthetic for the human eye. So again, if the short side is 1, the long side will be 1.618. It was used in designing the Parthenon in Greece, the Great Pyramid of Giza, and the United Nations building. So architects use it a lot for design because it's very aesthetically pleasing. Many of the things you use are patterned after the golden rectangle. Credit cards, playing cards, postcards, light switch plates, writing pads, so on and so forth. Artists such as Leonardo da Vinci, Van Gogh, and Monet use a golden rectangle in their works.
What they would do is they would take their canvas and they would divide it up into golden rectangles with the measurements, and they would paint based on that grid, and then whatever they produced would be pleasing to the human eye. So this is something that has been around that people have kind of known about for a long time, and it's interesting because you have all these precise mathematical patterns and formulas and things, and they all fit within the Fibonacci sequence. It gets even more interesting because not only is this used in architecture and human design, we find it in nature. So in plants and planets, the Fibonacci sequence occurs in the spiral arrangement of leaves around a plant's stem. If you look at a plant directly from above down the stem, you'll see the Fibonacci, the golden spiral in the Fibonacci sequence. It's the arc, the measurement of the arc of this stem from one leaf base to the next. So if you have a plant and you've got the leaf, I'm a horrible. This is why I'm not an artist, you guys. So if you have two leaves that are next to each other, the arc from the difference between the two is a Fibonacci number. And the reason it's like that is because it allows each leaf to get the exact amount of sunlight it needs to survive for photosynthesis. But the most interesting thing is that if you look at the different types of trees, so in the elm, the arc between the two is one half the circumference. In the beech and the hazel tree, it's one-third. And the oak is two-fifths. What's interesting about those numbers? They're all Fibonacci. The craziest part is, okay, so it just keeps getting crazier. So it's also found in the arrangement of flower petals, so same thing. So flower petals, the way that they go around the stem and then the seeds and all that, same thing. The planet's revolutions around the sun are the same ratios as the arrangement of leaves on plants. Okay, so this is the part where it gets a little confusing. But it's absolutely fascinating. If you look at the solar system, you have the sun here, right? And then you have, here I'm going to go forget them all, right? Mercury, Venus, I'm going to skip Earth for a second. Mars.
Jupiter.
I always think of... Memschnup.
Okay.
Saturn. Neptune. Uranus, Pluto, right? Other way.
Uranus, Neptune, Pluto.
Yeah.
No, Pluto.
I know. Now forget Pluto. Poor Pluto got kicked out. Yeah. Okay. If you start at Neptune and you go in towards the sun, it follows the Fibonacci sequence. So Neptune is, I just want to make sure I get this right. This one is half of Neptune. This is one third of this one. This is one fifth. Is five the next number?
Yeah.
Five?
One,
yeah.
Three, five,
this is one eighth, and then so on and so forth, all the way into the sun.
One half.
So of the circumference of the other one.
Oh.
Of the one preceding it. So it's crazy because literally it's an order of the Fibonacci sequence. The only one that's not there is an order is Earth. It skips. Mars skips to Venus. It goes from one-eighth to one-third. Sorry, this would be two-fifths.
One-third, two-fifths, three-eighths,
whatever the thing is. So, it skips over Earth. Almost as if the universe was created And then the earth was just put in there in this little spot known as the habitable zone, right? This is because of the anthropic principle. There is only one very tiny space in the Milky Way galaxy where the earth can exist and support human life. And it's in between what Mars would be and what Venus would be.
We call it the anthropic zone, or the Goldilocks zone. Some people call it. It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just perfect. So you can kind of see, the reason I'm going through all this is that this is no accident. There's order here. There's purpose here. And you can look all this up, too, if you want to look up. There's mathematicians that have done work on this, and you can kind of see this equation and the Fibonacci sequence and all that. So not only is it used in human designs, not only is it in nature, but it's also in the human skeleton and DNA. So if you look at the human being, their measurements, what do you say, the average human being, let's say, is around 0.612, which is very close to the golden ratio, 1 to 0.618 or 2. The interesting thing is that the curl in your eyelashes, part of your ear, your fingerprint, all those are the golden spiral. And then, you know, you've also got the length of your finger bones as compared to each other is 8, 5, 3, 2. They're all Fibonacci numbers. The crazy thing is the DNA strand is just one long line of golden rectangles. So, right, because it's like a ladder, right, but it's twisted. So your whole body is basically made up of these perfect proportions. Because what would happen if your body wasn't proportioned the way it's supposed to be? Your skeleton couldn't support your weight, you know, or vice, whatever it is, you wouldn't be able to exist the way that you do. So you have all of this design and all of this mathematically, you know, you can verify this with math. It's not like we're just making it up out of nowhere. Also, you've got the human eye, right? If you read Darwin's book, he admits in his book that the human eye really kind of made a mess of things for him, right? Because he's like, it's so complex. The visual system in human beings is incredibly complex, an integrated system which converts photons into meaningful information with incredible speed, unparalleled by modern video digitizing computers. Darwin said to suppose that the eye, with all of its abilities, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd to the highest degree. So even Darwin admits that the design of the human eye really kind of puts a thorn into his natural selection theory, right? Everything had to have been there all at the same time in order for the eye to exist and to function the way that it needed to.
I assume that when God created animals, he followed the same scheme too then, just like the plants.
Well, I mean, if you've never watched it, there's these great documentaries called Incredible Creatures That Defy Evolution. And it's fascinating. I mean, he talks about how the giraffe just killed me, because the way that giraffe's neck is created, basically, the giraffe's neck has these. It's great. Okay, so the giraffe's neck is really. It just gets me all excited. So its neck is, again, we're looking like a dinosaur here, right? Okay, so. In the giraffe's neck, you've got all of these little vertebrae, right? Well, it's also got all of these little flaps with basically like little lids that can open and close throughout its neck. And the reason it does that is because when the giraffe puts its head down, they all shut so the blood doesn't rush to its head. and then they open back up again when it puts its head up, right? Because it has to bend down to drink water. So the flaps all close in order for it to be able to drink water without all the blood rushing to its head and basically killing it. But the craziest thing is that it's got a little sponge at the base of its skull that collects all the little blood left over from the last one and absorbs it so that it doesn't, again, go into its head, and it, then it goes, then it releases back out when it goes. So there's all, I mean, but no other creature has that, right? So God created this perfect system for this animal that he knew would need to, like, constantly, but it would be hard because of, you know, all the blood and everything. So, but there's all these different stories like that on this documentary, and it's absolutely fascinating. So, yes, it does go into the animal kingdom. Molecular complexity. DNA possesses intelligent information called specified complexity. Obviously, it can self-replicate, proofread, splice itself, and is unable to be reproduced in the laboratory. It has 30,000 genes and 6 billion base pairs. Some species of primitive amoebas have as much information in their DNA as 1,000 Encyclopedia Britannicas. At the moment of conception, a fertilized human egg is about the size of a pinhead, yet it contains information equivalent to about 6 billion chemical letters. That's enough information to fill 1,000 books, 500 pages thick, with print so small you would need a microscope to read it. If all the DNA chemical letters in the human body were printed in books, it would be estimated that they would fill the Grand Canyon 50 times. So you have, like, this crazy amount of, you know, order and information, and it's, there has to be a designer here. This didn't just happen by chance. I mean, no one would say this happened by chance. So part of the teleological argument is you have to divide it. You divide it into fine-tuning and anthropic principle. Fine-tuning is the universe as a whole. How is the universe set up in order to function properly the way that it does? Second, how is it set up in order to make it so that man can survive and live on the earth? Because what? There's probably, I'm going to say probably, quote-unquote, no other species like us anywhere in the universe, right? Or in the other universes or whatever, if there's a multiverse, whatever it is. Because of the way that the universe is set up and where the earth is placed. So the anthropic principle focuses specifically on man, anthropos, man, and fine-tuning is specifically universe. So when you're talking with somebody about this argument, if you want to refer to how the universe is set up, you would use fine-tuning. If you want to talk about how it's perfectly set up for man, you would use anthropic principle. Specifically for the anthropic principle, we live on what's called a privileged planet. There's a DVD called The Privileged Planet. It's excellent. You could probably watch it on YouTube, actually, for free, now that I think about it. But there's 9 things you need for a habitable planet. You need liquid water, which means that what? You have to live in a place where you can have liquid water, that it's not so hot that it becomes gas, but not so cold that it constantly freezes. It needs to be uniquely suited for carbon-based life. Planet's distance from its home star has to be a specific amount of distance, right? Because if we were 1 degree closer, we would burn up. If we were 1 degree further away, we would freeze. Terrestrial planet has to have crust. We can't live on top of lava, right? We can't live on top of ice. There has to be something else that we can survive on. We have to be able to grow food. It has to be a nitrogen-oxygen atmosphere. The moon has to be placed in such a way that there are tides and not so high of a tide that it drowns everyone on Earth, but enough so that it constantly recycles what's happening on the Earth's crust. Type of home star, you need a specific type of home star to sustain carbon-based life. We have a G2 dwarf star. We're protected by giant planets. We are situated in such a way that we are protected by the 2 biggest planets from the asteroid belt, right? So they protect those asteroids constantly from hitting us because they absorb the impact. Magnetic field, we have iron in our core. And we have plate tectonics recycling. So the way that the crust and the earth is set up, it makes it so that we can survive. It's 1 with 15 zeros, 1 in 10 with 15 zeros, that all these factors would occur simultaneously, which is basically impossible. So there's 9 specific things that you need to have carbon-based life. The earth has them. It's basically impossible that the earth would have them. Therefore, someone had to have made it happen. Now, the crazy thing is that not only do we live in a place where we can survive, we also live in a place where God made it so that we could find him. So the factors needed for life also gives a best place for scientific observations. The Earth's atmosphere is transparent. We have very little carbon. We can see outside our planet, right? Atmosphere blocks out harmful rays, but visible light gets through so we can see. Galactic habitable zone. Again, our location in the Milky Way galaxy, we're halfway between the center and the ends. The center of the galaxy is dangerous because there's things like supernovas and black holes. But the outer rings don't have enough heavy elements to support an Earth-sized planet. So we're just in this perfect little spot. And then even within that habitable zone, there's areas that are dangerous for human life. So, I mean, it even narrows the odds even smaller. We're away from the dust from spiral arms, which means we get clear views. Why is it so important that we can observe the universe? Because God wants us to see him. He wants us to find him. It needs to be accessible to the human mind and eye. The universe is governed by laws that literally hold Earth and the cosmos together. God wants us to see evidence of him. So he didn't just leave us here with, here, I'm going to create the world and just hope that you figure it out. I'm going to create you and the world, and I'm going to make it so that you can figure out how it all happened and why. So it says what? Man's without excuse, right? Why?
So given all of this, what is the chance of life on another planet then? With all the new planets we're discovering?
Well, that's what I said. That's why I said, quote unquote, probably. Honestly, personally, because of all the factors that go into the fact that Earth can have us, I honestly don't think that exists anywhere else, just because the odds are so, low. But if there is, if we did ever find another place, it would have to have the same type of elements that, we do. If we ever found that, the chances are higher. But we haven't found that. As the further you go out, we have. But then again, there's other galaxies with their own home stars. But it depends on what type of star it is and things like that. So there's just so many factors that I don't believe there is. Would it change the gospel? I don't think so. I think God's big enough, But people like freak out like, oh, if there's aliens, I'm like, so what if there's aliens? As long as they don't come here and try to eat me, I'm like, it doesn't matter to me. I don't care either way, because my God's big enough to handle that.
It's strange how C.S. Lewis in his Perelandra suggests that
if
there is life on other planets, maybe it didn't fall like the Earth.
Right.
Maybe it didn't need Christ to come redeem it.
Right. But the series, that series is so interesting, though. Because the way that he ends it, and he talks about how they are they're still similar to us. That's a very interesting series. Okay, so third argument. I know I'm like going slow here. It's a moral law argument. So moral law equals moral law giver. There is a universal moral law. Therefore, there is a moral law giver. So again, we have to prove the two premises first. So
law equals lawgiver. There is a moral law. Therefore, okay.
So moral law equals moral lawgiver. So what is the evidence for the fact that there is a moral law? Well, to deny absolutes, first of all, is self-defeating, right? Because if you say there's absolutely no absolutes, the one thing you absolutely know is there are no absolutes. So everybody has a moral law inside of them, a sense of right and wrong. Most label it a conscience, a Jiminy Cricket personality, or the quintessential good and bad angels that sit on your shoulders, which that idea comes from Islam, which we'll talk about when we get to Islam. No one can deny that there's an absolute moral law. If one were to say there were no absolutes, it's self-defeating because he just made an absolute statement. If the moral relativist values his right to hold his opinion, does he think that everyone should have that freedom or right or just himself? Right? Because what if yours contradicts with his? Then who decides which one goes? Again, like I said before, why are governmental laws of morality similar or identical in most parts of the world if there are no moral absolutes? For example, everyone basically agrees that it's wrong to kill without just cause, right? And some people are like, oh, well, what about other cultures that believe this or that? That you can murder somebody, you know, because of this or whatever reason. And my friend Jim Wallace, he gave a good example. He said, if you take an evil act and you add just for fun at the end and it sounds wrong, that's probably something that everyone can agree is a moral absolute. Meaning, should you murder just for fun? Should you kick puppies just for fun? If it's something, if there's no just cause and you're just doing it for the pleasure of hurting something else, then that's probably something that almost everyone's going to agree on is wrong. Authors of the Declaration of Independence said that all men are endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable moral rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In America, obviously, that's something that we hold to, but it's also something that people in other countries hold to as well. Again, asked a relativist whether he thinks torturing babies for fun, murder, and rape is right for all people. So if someone just does it for pleasure, then and there's not a purpose behind it, then taking a life obviously is going to be seen as wrong most often. So atheists always bring attention to the problem of evil and injustice. If there's a loving, fair God, how can there be evil and injustice in the world? The problem with this whole train of thought, again, we talked about before, is that they have to have some standard of justice to call the world unjust. So if you ask a moral relativist, well, what would you say is wrong? They have to say something, right? Because then how do they know what right is? Even if the moral relativist denies morals with his words, he'll affirm them in his actions. For example, he'll be expected to be treated with fairness and respect and fair play. So if you try to cheat him in some way, he'll be like, wait a minute, you're cheating. Well, but I'm playing by my rules, you know? And so even if someone says, oh, I believe everyone's morality is relative, usually they're going to take that back the second it's imposed on them, right? So if there is a moral law, there's a moral lawgiver. There probably is a moral law, simply because we can see it by human nature, right? And that's why in C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, he calls moral law the law of human nature, because the laws of nature are what? Gravity, things like that. But the laws of human nature are, how can we expect humans to act or react or behave in a certain event or a certain situation? That would be the law of human nature. If we can anticipate how someone's going to act, how the average person's going to act. Obviously, we have to admit that there are crazy people out there that don't live in reality and don't react the way that we would hope they would, right? But most people live in reality and react the way that we would expect them to, which is the law of human nature. if we have a certain cause, we're going to get a certain effect. Therefore, there's a moral lawgiver. Because if something's universal, it has to be given what? Universally. And who's the only person that can give something universally? It'd be God. Okay. The last one I'm going to go into depth on is the argument from desire. This is actually my favorite one. Because I think that it works really well with everybody. Whether they're scientifically minded or not. It really works with almost everybody. So human beings desire a relationship with the divine, and we'll talk about the evidence of that in a second. Humans cannot desire something unless its fulfillment exists. Therefore, a divine being capable of relationship with human beings must exist. So this is actually my syllogism. There's there's a more formal one that's written by an apologist, but this particular, version of it is mine. Human beings desire a relationship with the divine. How do we know that? Well, first of all, reasoning as a Christian, I would say the Imago Dei, right? God created us in his image. What does it mean that God created us in his image? Does it mean we look like him? No, because God's spirit, so therefore we can't look like him physically. But if God created us in his image, that means what? One, we have his morality. And two, we have his logic. Right? So that's when I start getting into the moral law argument, and I start talking about, okay, well, if everyone agrees that certain moral laws or certain things are wrong and certain things are right, that would make sense because we're made in the image of a perfect and holy God. It's marred by the fall, obviously. There are things that you know, we sin because of that. So we're not perfect, but we're made in the image of a holy God, which means that we strive for what? To be good. Logic. We also strive to be right. We want to make sure that what we are doing is the right thing. And so we're made in God's image, obviously not physically, but in his kind of image, little attributes of his. Second, religion exists. Religion would not exist if human beings did not desire a relationship with the divine. It just simply wouldn't, because what is religion? Religion is man reaching out to God, right? Religion is man trying to find what the purpose is in everything. So from that point, you could actually reason to specifically monotheism. Human beings not only desire a God, they desire a specific type of God. They desire a God that looks a certain way, that looks like the first cause, that is a God who will save them. They're looking for a savior. So there's different things that you can reason to within this. Humans cannot desire something unless its fulfillment exists. If something did not exist, would you know to desire it? So, like, for example, if chocolate didn't exist, would we want it? No, because we wouldn't know to desire it in the first place, right? So you can't desire something unless its fulfillment exists. I call this the principle of fulfillability. So the only way you can desire something is if you have information about it before you desire it. So you desire things a posteriori or after you know about something. So you have to have been given the information about this thing before you can want it. Otherwise, you wouldn't want it. If human beings want God, then at some point in time, we had to have been given information about this God, right? I think that's because we were created the Imago Dei. Even though I'm getting tired at the end of the night here. So step one, God creates us in his image, right? In the Imago Dei. One thing about the Imago Dei is that God is a what? He's a Trinity, right? But he's been a Trinity from eternity. So he's a being in communion with himself. He's a being in relationship with himself. So, and he's satisfied in that. He doesn't need us. God's fully perfect, satisfied in that relationship with himself, right?
So if God has been in a relationship with himself for all time, and then we are created in him, his image, then it would make sense that we crave a relationship with him as well. Because that's how he is, and so that's what we... So, two, the fall happens, right? Man creates us in God creates us in his image. We desire a relationship with God because that's how he is. The fall happens, but it doesn't completely erase us being made in his image, right?
It mars it a little bit, but it doesn't completely erase it. So there's still that little, like, shadow, and C.S. Lewis calls them shadows, little shadow of something that was there before the fall that we are striving to get back to. So that's why I put desire here. So God creates us, the fall happens, then there's shadows. The shadows of what we once had, that taste of perfection, now lead to the fact that we desire it, right? So C.S. Lewis said, creatures are not born with desires unless the satisfaction for these desires exists. A baby feels hunger while there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim while there's such a thing as water. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly desires were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it or to suggest the real thing. So if humans really need something, then the fulfillment probably exists. Otherwise, we wouldn't need it, right? We need a creator outside of this world in order to hold things together, right? Because we can't hold the universe together ourselves. So that we have these real needs in order to survive that are dependent on a transcendent creator. So... And there's this apologist, and he said that humans have this feeling of being deposed royalty. That we have this feeling inside of us that we were actually meant to be placed in a higher hierarchy. But something happened, and now we are in this lower place, but yet we feel like we should be higher. We feel like we belong in this higher rank. And so we're constantly striving to get back to that, which, you know, obviously that's where pride comes from and all that. But it's just interesting because you can kind of see this in human nature. You see, you know, people are like, oh, gosh, I really wish that this was true. I really wish that there was a God, and I really wish there wasn't evil. And well, that's because there was once a time when there wasn't evil, and there was once a time when we were perfect and we didn't have sin. And so that's why we're constantly desiring those things. Okay. So the other thing, too, is that we desire things not just like, remember how we're talking about, is truth all that is existentially relevant, things that we just need to survive. So as human beings, what do we desire? Is all that we desire food, water, shelter? We desire more than that, right? We desire what? Love, friendship, beauty. Truth. We desire metaphysical things. Well, why would we desire metaphysical things if there wasn't metaphysical things? So we were created in the image of a metaphysical being, which is why we have desires for metaphysical things, because if we weren't created in his image and we didn't desire him, all we care about is the physical things. So because we do desire emotional things, that tells you that there had to be something metaphysical at the beginning. Otherwise, we wouldn't have those desires in us at all. For companionship, for example. Why do we desire companionship? Because God has companionship. So being, I personally feel that being made in the image of God, the fall happened, but we still desire all those things that we were created in the image of. And, you know, people will disagree. People say, like, oh, no, that's your chemical synapses and your brains are firing, and that's why you love, and that's why you, you know, this and that. But those things wouldn't happen if we weren't created in the image of God. So there had to have been a God at the beginning. Okay, other arguments. There's the ontological argument. This is created by Anselm. And God is by definition that than which nothing greater can be conceived. Meaning that you can't imagine anything greater than God. It is greater to exist in reality than to exist only in the mind. Therefore, God must exist in reality. If he didn't exist, he wouldn't be the greatest possible. I know this is like really stretching the brain here, but you can't imagine anything greater than God, basically, is what he's saying. And because of that, God must exist in reality if he's what we measure the greatest existence of. Does that make sense? So if God didn't exist, he wouldn't be the greatest thing we could possibly imagine, but he is. Therefore, he probably exists. And that one's a doozy for even the smartest people. If you don't get it right away, like, people spend years studying that one. So that's why I don't go through that one in detail, because if you want to know more about that, you can study it yourself. arguments from intelligence. Anthropological argument. If man is an intelligent being, only intelligence can produce the intelligent, therefore an intelligent being created man. Biological argument, life is a highly complex organism. Highly complex information results from an intelligent cause, therefore there is an intelligent creator. You're going to get pushback on the first one sometimes by people who believe in panspermia. Panspermia is the idea that life was planted here by extraterrestrial beings, and that's how we get intelligence. For example, when, I don't know if you guys saw, there was a documentary called Expelled a few years back, and Richard Dawkins was interviewed, and he was so staunchly against admitting that God could be the cause of everything, that he was even willing to go for panspermia over theism, because he's so adamantly anti-God that he was even like, you know, he wasn't willing to deny that the intelligence needs intelligence. So when he was pushed on it, he's like, well, maybe intelligence was planted here by, you know, some beings at the beginning. And we're like, wait a minute. You're willing to believe that aliens planted Earth or life on Earth rather than God because you're just so unwilling to admit to a, you know, theistic creator. So you will get some pushback on that one by people who believe in panspermia. Biological argument, life is a highly complex organism, highly complex information results from intelligent cause, therefore is intelligent creator. Again, you're going to get pushback on that one from atheists who are going to say, oh, well, your body is just has evolved to a point of being able to survive and be complex. But Michael Behe, who I don't know if you guys have heard of him, but he's a scientist who basically proved something called irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity basically means that in order for a organism or a machine to work, it has to have all of its parts from the very beginning. So in order for a cell, even a one-celled organism, one-celled organisms are highly complex. So if you've got a one-celled organism and it has all these little parts to it, let's say, it has to have all these parts in order to survive at all, right? So if you take away one and you say, oh, it evolved these parts, so say this is the final
version, let's say, the version before in the process of evolution is missing one, right? So there's a part missing out here. So this is a step in the evolutionary process. And then you go back even further, same thing, another step in evolution, and you've got four now.
He's saying if it needs all of these things to survive and to live, it had to always have all those things. Meaning this is the complexity, this is the most simply complex it can be. It has to be all of this at the beginning in order for it to survive. Meaning you can't reduce the complexity anymore, otherwise it wouldn't survive. So basically, if you look at cells, cells are irreducibly complex. You can't take away a piece of it and have it survive to the next step in evolutionary process. So he's saying it had to have started complex at the beginning. And if it started complex at the beginning, that means it didn't evolve. So, but he's got a really great book called Darwin's Black Box that if you feel like having your brain hurt, you could check that one out. But he gives all the science behind it, and he talks about how there's no way even the simplest cell could have evolved because it has to have all of its parts at the very beginning in order for it to survive, basically. Okay, so lastly, if there is a God who can act, there can be acts of God. So we have all these arguments for the existence of God. They're pretty good ones. There's a lot more out there, but I just gave you guys a few. But if there's a God, we have good evidence for that. There can be acts of God. Again, like I said, you're going to get people who are like stuck on the whole like, did Moses part the Red Sea thing. You're going to get people who are like, did the whale swallow Jonah? If God can create the world, the rest of that's easy, right? So in order to build a case for miracles, which is what we're going to do next week, you first have to establish the fact that God is an all-powerful God who did all these, you know, amazing things in the first 7 days of creation. Once you get past that point, miracles are easy, right? So next week we'll talk about miracles. Because if there's a God that can act, there could be acts of God. So, yeah, that's the end. And I'm tired and spent.